Accession number 1193H, rail 25.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 25. Would you continue with your description of the box at Gazala, Mr. Iston?
Yes, well, from Gazala on the coast, the box went, the minefields went from Gazala to Bir Hakeim, some 45 miles. And in that, there was a first South African Div, part of the second South African Div, 50 division, and at the very bottom, 150 Brigade, 6 miles from 69th Brigade, and 13 miles from 150 Brigade to the Free French, which left the Free French right out in the open, in a sense, except that they were inside the minefield. The boxes had minefields front and back. The main minefield obviously being on the front, and there were about, I think we had two gaps on our battalion front. I think there were two gaps.
Did they have names, these gaps?
Yes, the main one we used was Auckland Gap. It had been the Rajutapani Gap, but when we got there it obviously changed to the Auckland Gap, and then there was another one I think was the Darlington Gap. I think it was three actually. But the one mainly in use was the Auckland Gap.
When you talk about gaps, how wide were these gaps in the minefield?
The width of a trut, 6 feet, 7 feet. And they had mines which were there ready to fill the gaps. The mines were laid just at the side of the tape. The gaps were taped with white tape. And just to the side of the white tape, there were the mines which went in to fill the gaps, should it be necessary to seal it off altogether.
So they're about a truck wide now. How deep was the gap?
I would think they varied in depth according to the difficulty of the place. Mainly, there would be something like 50, 60 yards in depth. And the minefields went stretched the full 45 miles from the coast down, and something like 50 yards in depth.
Auckland Gap then would be a gap of the width of a truck stretching some 50, 60 yards.
Yes. I can't recall now the distance apart that the mines are. I do recall that on the beaches in Devon, a bull got among them. It's set 60 miles off because they were too close, and they were all re-gapped after that. They were lifted and replaced. So I can't honestly call the distance. The armies were responsible for laying them with infantry. The infantry probably laid them, but it was under RE instructions. But not in my field at all, I'm afraid.
So when you drove into your box, do you recall what your immediate impressions were?
Well, the first thing was that we're on the wrong side of the slope. we're on a downward slope, which meant that we could be seen from some distance away, which I suppose was the right place to be, because the desert in that particular place was remarkably flat. Until we'd been there some time, you couldn't see any feature at all, and then we gradually realised that for instance, we had an outpoint which was a mile outside of the wire, an outpost which was manned night and day for the total period we were there, and there was a cable back from there to Battalion Advanced Headquarters, and they were a mile out. And the only reason we knew where that was because there was an ambulance which had been shut up and left there, and it was called Ambulance Point. Well, that was the only reason you could tell that that was there. After we'd been there some time, we'd been done quite a lot of patrols out on the front, then we realised that there were cairns in various places. There were burrs or wells in various places. And for instance, on the German side, there was one ridge which ran in front of them, which was called Eichel Ridge, and a ridge behind it, which had an Arabic name, but the front one was Eichel Ridge, and then there was another one which we used to visit. I should explain straight away, I think, that at the Gazala end of the line, the Germans were something like 4 miles away. But at the Bir Hakeim end of the mile, there was something like 45 miles away, because their line was in the same formation. It was close at the top, and then they both lines went further apart as they went south. Our idea was that if he wanted to attack Tobruk, he had to go right round Bir Hakeim, and that was taking him well into the desert, and uncharted desert. Our long-range desert groups had done some maps and given us some idea. There were camel tracks all the way across the desert, where, in fact, there were some cultivated parts of the desert, or there had been some cultivated parts of the desert, where people had established their homeland. The nomads, the Senussi, had established their own little farm, I suppose you might say, and there was tracks all the way over the desert. And once you got to know where these cairns were and where the tracks crossed and things like that, it got to be quite simple to know where you were. You couldn't tell one track from another once you were on it at night. I mean, if you hit a track, you couldn't tell which one it was until daylight. You found something, unless you just happened to hit on a cairn where the tracks crossed or something like that. But
these tracks were basically just flattened soil or... And it had been flattened by camels.
Just flattened by camels' feet, basically, yes. That's how it had started.
Similar to sheep tracks.
Similar to sheep tracks on the mountain. I mean, if you go on a mountain today, in fact, in the country in Britain, most of our roads twin and twine, simply because the horse was set off in a cart and the driver fell asleep, and the horse found the easiest way, so the roads twist all over the place. Well, these tracks were similar. The camels... did much, very much their own thing. They were in a caravan, and the leading camel would do its own thing, more or less, and decide which was going to be the easiest way for it to travel. So the tracks went across, roughly in the direction which they wanted. As we picked the troops up from the railhead, they told us about... being strapped, and the New Zealand driver and the fireman on the train had been, after they'd got the railhead, the New Zealand, the fireman and the driver had been wounded, and bombs had been dropped. Not a lot of damage done, but the driver and the fireman were wounded, and they had to find replacements for the train to go back. The trains were run by the railway company of the Regiment Royal Engineers. And they had their own traffic people, and they ran the trains completely. In fact, they took over, I think, the whole of the Egyptian railway. I think the Egyptians still ran the blue train from Suez to Cairo and onwards. But virtually the whole of the Egyptian railway was run by the RE companies of the engineers. So after picking these up, we were in... proper open-air formation, artillery formation. And it is frightening when you see a plane in the sky coming dead towards you, and you have a good idea that it's not yours. But you still kept going, and unfortunately, I think the 8th Battalion, I think they lost two vehicles.
This was going into the box?
Going into the box, yes, before we got to the box itself. And... It's not a very nice feeling, especially when they're coming out the sun, and you can just sort of see a shape in the sun, which was at night. We were travelling at night, and they were coming out the sun.
So you went into the box during the evening, during the night?
Yes, I think so. We stopped outside the box, I think, the first night, and we left the B echelon, which was the quartermaster's staff and the... some of the cooks and people who weren't not fighting people, administration people, battalion headquarters, the main battalion headquarters was left behind in there. And they all formed up as a brigade B echelon with brigade headquarters. They were outside the box at that time. And they stayed out of there until the flap really started. And when the flap started, they came back into the box, and that caused a panic, because by that time we'd all got everything dug in. All our vehicles were dug in. The RAs, in fact, came up then with, I suppose we've been in the box about 6 weeks, or maybe 2 months. The RAs came up with loading shovels and dug spaces out to get the trucks backed in out of the way.
What's a loading
shovel? A loading shovel is a tracked vehicle with a scoop on the front with hydraulically controlled, and it will lift, dig into the soil, lift it up, and then the vehicle tracks away, and it can deposit it just where it's required. Very often they used to dig into the soil, lift it up and deposit it on the front, so it gave extra height. As well as going down, it protected them in the front as well, in case shells landed in front. Splinters were going in the soil and protected as well. In some cases, of course, they had to be blasted, because it was solid sandstone. Not I think it would move at all. It was just solid sandstone, and that was blasted. And of course, any shell holes or bomb holes that were around, they were immediately used as to dig the vehicles in. So by the time we'd been there, the Indians had started this off, but by the time we'd been in there 3 or 4 months, everything was more or less dug in. The 25-pounders, they dig themselves in. It's part of their ritual. If they're in a pretty static position, they dig their guns into barrel level so they can fire straight ahead, but they don't normally fire straight ahead, but they're usually elevated. But they dug in until the barrel is just above the soil, and it means that their ammunition and that is below ground level. But you've got to remember that the hole for a gun is quite a big place, so it isn't really, it's not like a trench, which is narrow. A splinter could go inside a gun emplacement quite easily, because it's such a big place, and a splinter could just fall anywhere inside it. But even so, it meant that they're away from the main blast, unless they've got a direct hit.
Where did you find your particular positions?
Well, part of that quarter company went forward. Most of the fitters stayed behind with B echelon, and because I was single and most of them were married, it was decided that I would go forward, and I stayed in the box with George Adams. He was married, actually, as it happened, but he was the Rini fitter, and the two of us, we went forward into the box, and we dug ourselves. Whether it was fortunate or not, I don't really know, because there was a little, as I said, we were on a forward-facing slope, and right behind us was a little hump, and on top of the hump there was a Bofors gun, manned at that time by the Thumbland Yeomanry, I think it was. A good Northumberland and good North of England outfit. I'm not sure it was the Yeomanry. And very good they were, very good, as we knew later on, because they were replaced at one stage by the Poles. And the Poles were fired everything they could see. Anything, it could be miles in the sky and they would have a shot at it. Well, of course, by the time we needed the ammunition, there wasn't any. They'd used it all up. But the Northumberland Yeomanry, they were economical with it, but if anybody came to, no, they were following it all the way. But I don't think they fired a shot unless it was within range. But the Poles, like you see the Arabs today when they're doing the fighting, they stood up and they haven't even got the rifle on their shoulder, but they're letting rounds go anywhere. None of them going to tell. And the Poles, I'm afraid, were in the same attitude. They, as long as they were firing, they were happy. They were getting shot of ammunition. They thought it was good. So did we at the time. Until, as I said, we're when we wanted it, there was no ammunition.
So you dug yourself in. What kind of positions did you dig yourself in?
Well, we dug, provisionally, we dug a slit trench. And then we extended that by going underneath and propping the top up. So that in the end, there was room for the two of us to lay flat and be covered. And we had a sheet which went over the slit trench, which was our original thing, and that stopped any light. So, in fact, we could run a light from a battery, and we could read a little bit when it was dark without any fear of being caught out at all. I think at that time I had a Dodge 1500 weight vehicle, which we used to get round in the box to any repairs which needed doing. We had water,
in 40 gallon. How did you hide the vehicle? Was it just stuck on the top?
It was stuck on the top originally, but as I said, by the time we'd been there 2 or 3 months, everything was done in, dug in, even the vehicle was covered. The water was dug in, the petrol and the oil store, they were all, everything was dug in by the time that we'd been there a few months. We were quite comfortable, really. As I explained before, I was always one for collecting sheets, tarpaulins of any description or any size. They were always handy because you might, in some cases, just flick a sheet underneath a vehicle's wheel and that was just enough to take it on, as you can do in this country in snow. If you've got a vehicle in snow, you can very often just throw a bag underneath and there's just enough grip to take it that little bit further forward. So we're always collecting sheets wherever we could, and we were quite comfortable, I must admit. Maurice Kirby, he was responsible for S Company. Ah, that's a thing now. He was responsible for S Company mess, and being a builder, he'd dug it down and put fine mesh up and around the walls. He just looked as though he had net curtains all the way around. It was all underground. And he had armchairs made out of sandbags, and he really went to town with it. And I believe the HQ officer's mess was quite good as well. I was never actually in it.
You were basically looking after your own comforts.
Yes,
right?
Yes, to a certain extent. No, we weren't in tents at all. Nobody was in tents. I don't think anybody was in tents then. It was all dug in, and you made it as comfortable as you could yourself. In fact, to be quite candid, I believe that some of the infantry lads did quite a lot of digging for George and myself, because we were so busy trying to keep vehicles on the move. You must remember that at this time there was only two of us in the box, and we had all the carriers and all the vehicles, the echelon vehicles, we had all of them to look after and service. So we had no time to spare at all. And then when the boxes started, the jock column started going out, I went more or less with them. There was a jock column went out roughly every 2 weeks with one company, a different company. We'll come to the jock columns eventually, but they went out every other week to various parts of the no man's land. And I was away with them most of the time, so it meant that George was left on his own for quite a lot of the time. And he was really worked off his feet.
Well, as you say, we'll come to the jock column. How did you organise such things as hygiene and food and so on?
Well, we must have been close to the company headquarters, because the cooks, headquarter company cooks, were quite... Not headquarter company cooks. There were some cooks quite close to us. Headquarter company cooks were back with Beerschlam. But there were cooks quite close to us, and we must have attached ourselves, I think, possibly to S Company, because that was one of the major companies. S Company came along, I don't know exactly where it started, but certainly on the desert we had what was known as S Company, which was the Bren gun carriers, the mortar platoon, and by then we had an anti-tank platoon of 2 troops, 8 guns. 2 pounders at this stage. Later they would get 6 pounders, but this, when we first got there, there was 2 pounders. And there was a bit of a recce people who I think were really part of the carrier. But there was the carrier platoon, the mortar platoon, the anti-tank, and there was one other.
Anti-aircraft?
No, because they came under headquarters and they were, as I've said, they were the buglers, actually, the anti-aircraft. I think there's one other platoon in the S Company. And I think by this time, Maurice Kirby was actually a captain and he was in charge of S Company. He was S Company commander. And, of course, the carriers, apart from having to do their stint on the jock columns, they also sent one section of carriers plus one mortar carrier, 3-inch mortar carrier, plus I think 2 guns, machine guns from the Cheshires, went out every day to take a relief column out to the listening post, which was a mile away, and then they went out as far as ever they could into no man's land to see what was happening to what the Germans were up to, listening, trying to find out. Now, somebody I really must mention, because I thought they were terrific, were the South African armoured cars, who stayed out of the box nearly all of their time. They were in no man's land nearly all of their life, and they were just patrolling around listening and keeping an eye on people. And they used to, when we were out on the jock column, they would come into the jock column and give us information for our signals to send back to division, because when we went out on a jock column, we were actually under division control. We were a company from the 6DLI, still responsible to the colonel of the 6DLI, but we were actually under divisional control. So we had signalers from division who were in direct and had their own ciphers and everything, and they passed the messages from the jock column straight back to division. And the South Africans used to come in occasionally to pass messages to the column commander, and he would put it through to division, and then it would go back and take it to corps and then to army and vice versa. But the South African armoured cars, they were terrific people. I don't think they had the Rolls Royce. I think it was the Marvin. Anyway, they had a similar car to the Rolls Royce, but I don't think it was the actual Rolls Royce.
Can we just, before we go on to jock columns and the actual operations you were involved in, spend a little more time on life within the box to get the picture of just how you lived. Food you were attached to S Company, as they were.
I think with S Company, yes.
Toilets and that kind of thing. How does that overcome?
Toilets were the same slip trench with Essien around it. And while I'm thinking about it, we lost one lad. Actually, sat on the toilet. There wasn't a mark on him, but his back was broken from a blast. But there wasn't a mark anywhere on him. But the blast broke his back. Just poor lad was sat on the toilet.
It's a bomb and blast.
No, a shell blast. this was much later on from what we're talking about now. But it did happen in the box, just not far from where we were. We had our little dugout.
What was the water situation?
The water was 0.5 gallon per man, which went to the company quartermaster sergeant. It was brought in by water wagons. At this time we had 3. And it was brought in by the water wagons. The RSC brought it from, I think, Tobruk, in bulk tankers, to the B echelon. And the water wagons went from A echelon to the B echelon and collected the water, and then they brought it up to the company quartermaster sergeant. And it was rationed to 0.5 gallon per man per day. Half of that went to the cooks. I think the water bottle took £2. Oh, wait a minute now. Half a gallon. £2 went to the cooks for the tea and the stews and whatever they were making. The water bottle took a pint, and we're allowed a pint for washing, shaving, and which we didn't, because we would drink that water and we'd scrounge water from somewhere else for washing and shave. We did wash and shave. We were remarkably clean, I must have, you know. The washing didn't get done as much as we would have liked it to be done, but we were remarkably clean. I don't remember seeing any bats or anything like that. All the time we're in the box. There is a story of some people down at the railhead. In fact, there was a railway company, and an officer came along with a box with a chimney behind him, and they started talking, and he said, "I've come to give you a shave." He said, "What for?" "We shaved this morning." "Oh, I don't mean off your face, I mean all over." And he was the delousing man. But this was way back at the railhead. It was nowhere near us at all. I don't ever remember seeing them come in the boxes at all. Well, I did describe the delousing thing when we were in France. We saw one in France. Well, a similar thing happened in the desert. And there, it was really more necessary than it was in France, because there was a terrific shortage of water.
What was the food like?
It was what we'd been getting. It was bully stew, McConaughey stew. McConaughey's were great, we used to think so anyway. Fish, tinned fish. Later on, we started getting tins with rolls of bacon in, which you could, was bacon cut in slices and rolled it all the way, so you could just get hold of a sheet of the paper and stretch it out, and you got a row of slices of bacon. But they were to cook. It was great though when it was cooked. I mean, that was something really new. Occasionally we would get bread, white bread in the army square loaves. But by the time we got it, the outside and most of the inside was full of dust. No matter how they tried to cover this bread, the dust got in. And when you see bread today in the supermarket, all wrapped up in cellophane and all this, it's really annoying to think of what the sand that we ate. Because, to be fair to the lads driving the store's truck who went to collect this bread, they did everything possible. But when you've got a canopy on the top and a vehicle travelling along sand, it's sucked inside the canopy. I mean, you could see it if you see photos of lads travelling in the desert. They're white, purely white, and caked. Not just dust on, it's caked on. So the bread was always sand in. The water was always salty, because they were taking more from the... It was desalinated water in most cases. And they were taking so much water that they couldn't get the salt. They didn't have time to take the salt out properly. I mean, it should be steamed, and you should condense the steam. And then, of course, you've taken too much salt out, so it's difficult. But it was terrible water. Once, Quartermaster Runciman, we'd lost Frank Robson. He went to be the... Brigade Quartermaster or something. And Jack Runciman took over as quartermaster. And he did once find a well which had beautiful water. And talking of water, I must mention that in No Man's Land, there was a bird, I forget the Bertolata. I think it was Bertolata, which had beautiful water. And the Germans and ourselves used to queue up to get the water. You know, the lads in the carriers, you see, they were the only ones really who could get near to this place, and they used to go up with as many cans as they could, 2-gallon water cans. And the story is that they used to queue up to go in and get the water and pull out again.
Some kind of unofficial truce.
Yeah. It wasn't a truce in a sense. I suppose that they could have gone and fought for the water. But rather than do that, they were more keen to get the water. And so they did this queuing up thing, and they both got water. It was really, really good water. Got one.